ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
and
energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Behrendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
This, conventional understanding that, you know, Indigenous knowledge was almost a resource or, you know, something to be extracted, and Indigenous people were always the informants. So this notion of collaborating or having Indigenous people as co-authors or co-inventors was very new and alien and in some ways very confronting.
Terry Jenke on challenging stereotypes in the legal sector and the threat of AI to Indigenous cultural knowledge. This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Behrendt. Advances in technology are forcing us to reconsider how best to protect traditional Indigenous culture and heritage. Terry Jenke is a Wathathi, Yadigana and Miriam lawyer and writer who was born on Cape York Peninsula in North Queensland before her family moved to Canberra. She's known for her knowledge, passion and groundbreaking work on the protection of Indigenous cultural and intellectual property, or ICIP. She's been involved in the development of ICIP law across the arts, film, museum and archival sectors. She's also a founder of Terry Jenke & Company, Australia's oldest and largest privately owned Indigenous law and consulting firm. I've known Terry since I was in my late teens, and we met when we were at law school together and we connected straight away. I've been wanting to have her on the show for a long time now, and I've finally been able to pin her down. Having known her when we were both starting out in our careers, it's been inspiring to see what she's achieved and the impact she has had.
I grew up in Cairns, far north Queensland. That's where I was born. My heritage is Cape York and Torres Strait Islander. And I just grew up in Cairns. My mum and dad, John and Joanna Jenke. I have a brother, JP Jenke, and my older sister, Tony Jenke. I'm the middle child, so we sort of grew up there, but moved to Canberra. And I went to high school in Canberra on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country. And yeah, that was interesting because we had a lot of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that were working in government used to come around our house and stuff. And I would hear yarns, you know, from people like Jackie Huggins and Charlie Perkins and, you know, people like that were available to me, or I could look at them and see what they were doing in government. And, you know, this is in the 70s and 80s. And, I watched on. My dad worked in hostels and then the old Aboriginal Development Commission, which is now IBA, and then he moved to foreign affairs. But my mum worked in education, Aboriginal education, and that was really pretty interesting because at the time the NAEC and all of that was happening and all the development of Aboriginal education policies. So we were just exposed to all of that. I didn't know any lawyers as a small kid, but Pat O'Shane was, from Cairns, and I remember my parents knew her, and I remember her coming to the house once and my mum saying, oh, you know, Pat's a lawyer. And I honestly didn't know what a lawyer did, but she was pretty inspirational. And my sister and I and my brother just became very interested in social justice and Indigenous rights as kids growing up in, in an era where racism was much more overt. And we wanted to, well, I particularly wanted to work in an area that could advance social justice. And that's where the idea of law sprung up. I was really influenced by my sister Tony, who is a year older than me and was going to UNSW. And so I followed her when I left school and didn't know that this area of law, intellectual property, existed. I thought, you know, it might be like criminal law or the American television shows, which were like LA Law at the time, or, you know, I guess that's like Suits is at the moment. So that was sort of forming into me ideas of what it could be. But, you know, I was a pretty shy kid. I didn't really want to work in the courts. I thought judges were scary. But it was finding the arts that really got me into intellectual property, because my family were always artistic, very musical, performance-based. We had artists coming around the family, like old, he's passed on now, Dick Ruffsey would come, you know, in Cairns. And I had a break in law school, Larissa, and I worked at the Aboriginal Arts Board of the Australia Council, as it was called then, and that just illuminated the arts scene, the First Nations arts scene for me. But that's when I started to learn about the shortfalls in protecting Aboriginal art by using copyright, and the fact that it was becoming lucrative now was opening it to rip-offs, you know, copycat art on T-shirts and souvenirs, but also this idea of appropriating Indigenous cultural stories, Indigenous cultural identity. And that's where I got interested in intellectual property and the movement of Indigenous cultural and intellectual property.
I remember a class we had together was property law, and I'm very sorry, but I'm going to reveal how old we are here, because it was just before the Mabo case came down. So we really spent a year studying Whitefella law the Whitefella way. And then you took the break afterwards. But I wonder what your reflections are on what it was like for you going into that environment, because there weren't many of us there in the law school, but and it's not always that when people leave studying law that they come back, and you did, and obviously not only that, but you embraced law as a career very successfully afterwards. So can you share a little bit about what that part of the journey was, why you decided to stop, and what actually was the moment where you decided to come back and complete?
Yeah, it was before the Mabo case that I did property law for the first time. And, you know, we were learning terra nullius and those cases
that were
backing it up.
I think you and I were the only ones that read it, because it was the teacher said it wasn't going to be in the exam. So I'm pretty sure you and I were the only two that read the
cases. It was. And I still remember that big, thick blue book. And that was like the only Indigenous part of the, you know, land law. And it was really difficult at the first go at uni. And, you know, I had my sister there, which was good. She was a good student and seemed to get through, you know, without having a break, as did you, Larissa. But I took these things really deeply and thinking about what I would do. You know, even when you start thinking about the concept of law, and we do that historical background introduction to law, you're really aware that this is Whitefella law that you're learning, and that it is, you know, a system that's set up to justify the way society deals with things and rules and property and rights and all of that. So you become aware that it's like the dominant culture that is the main focus for the law. And so for me, I was always trying to get a handle of it and understand it. And there are a whole lot of kids that they knew each other. I came from Canberra. I didn't really know anyone in my class. In the first years, I know we overlapped in some, but you're often just sitting there by yourself. And when topics would come up around Indigenous themes, it would feel uncomfortable, you know. And these days they have Indigenous support people, you know, they have the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander centres that we go to. I mean, we had one, but it was in its really formative days, wasn't it? Not to the extent that it is today.
And that the numbers weren't what they are now as well. There were very few of us in those classrooms. I did that class with you, and I think I did one class with my brother, but then like you, every other class, I was the only Indigenous person there, and you were so right. I remember being in criminal law and they would talk about Aboriginal people in really deficit ways, and we were all statistics, and you'd sit there and think, that's my lived experience?
Yeah. And you wouldn't, I didn't feel like talking up or backing up those deficit sort of views either. And, you know, I was quiet and shy to talk in class sometimes. And, you know, I dropped out in third year. And, you know, it was after failing property law and not really understanding that. But, you know, I also had a situation where I did like a summer clerkship working for, an organisation, a company that went to court and being mistaken for a defendant in, you know, there when I'm, while the judge is calling out the next cases.
No, it's terrible.
Yeah, it was really confronting, and I couldn't see where I would be going if I became a lawyer. The big firms felt so alien to me. And I dropped out. And the point that I came back, a whole lot of things happened. Mabo happened. So I dropped out in 1990, maybe 1991. And then 1992, you know, that was the Mabo case. So, you know, I was watching that flare up in the papers and thinking, wow, look, there's a group of people, you know, Eddie Mabo and other Merriam people were taking action. And it was a long case, but it was a successful way where the law could be used as a sword instead of a shield for Indigenous people. And it was more empowering than, you know, we were in the era of black deaths in custody was really big when we were there, criminal law and all of that. And land rights, and it seemed like, like you said, the language very deficit, the focus very deficit. So Mabo coming through was, I was watching that, and I was really influenced in the possibilities of the law. And then having this realization around copyright law, which really fascinated me, that there were rules in an act that related to how ideas were owned and who would be able to control reproduction and get benefits from ideas and artistic creations. And I remember going to a session which was led by the Australian Copyright Council for staff at Australia Council, and they spoke about copyright, and I could see that, oh, look, that doesn't really apply for Indigenous people because it's an oral-based culture. Copyright looks for material form to protect works and creations. And, you know, copyright will vest in the person writing down the cultural knowledge of Aboriginal people. So it's empowered a lot of non-Indigenous anthropologists or, you know, commentary by others that have interpreted their versions of culture. And alongside of that, we had Aboriginal people talking about how they were misrepresented by the record, by people telling stories. And so copyright became fascinating to me, and I just realised that is it. Went back, but I was also very influenced by the chair of the Australia Council at the time, Lynn Onus. They set up an organisation called the National Indigenous Arts Advocacy Association, which ran the first copyright cases on, you know, the $10 note, Yumbalul and Reserve Bank, and then Milperu and Indofirm, the carpets case. And I got to work on that. And it was the first case that recognised that Aboriginal art could be protected by copyright, that just because these designs followed traditional expressions that were handed down through the generations, individual artists could have their own skill, labour and effort and have copyright. Because in the past, people just dismissed it as public domain, free to use. And that really sparked a whole new way of thinking for me. And when I went back to uni, I was pretty focused and just did all my subjects that were related to having a career in that path. And I was more ready to speak up in class and speak to the lecturers about how I wanted to have that area of law have some Indigenous content. You know, I would want to do an assignment on an Indigenous aspect. If I was doing corporations law, for example, or environmental law, or, you know, that was a really, dropping out, I thought I'd never go back, Larissa, and there you go. I found that.
Yes, I was going to say, I think we can't really say you dropped out. You took a pause and a really great moment you took to just kind of really orient yourself and then come back really strongly. I wonder if you can take us through, you know, I think one of the many significant things you've done since you graduated from law school, apart from pioneering a lot of the ideas that were no doubt formulating from law school, but you were amongst the very first Aboriginal lawyers to set up their own practice. And I wonder if you can take us through how the young woman who took a pause in her legal studies and then came back, then started her own firm.
I never thought that I'd have my own law firm. Things happen that lead you to, I guess, thinking about how you can respond to gaps in the legal profession, and I moved to step up. But, you know, when I left law school, I had opportunities to work in big law firms in the city, which I had experience of, and worked in IP sections there, but there were no Indigenous clients and I was still very far away on doing the work that I wanted to do. So I chose to work in a smaller firm called Michael Frankel & Company, and Michael was a real advocate in film law, and he had worked with a lot of Indigenous clients, filmmakers, and he and his team were really great people. And so I went to work with them. And that's where I got to work on the Our Culture, Our Future report, which was a large project commissioned by ATSIC, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission, and the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies. And that was to look at this area of law. It was actually, you know, if I think back then, you know, in the there was a social justice package around after Mabo, and one of the limbs was to look at this area of Indigenous cultural and intellectual property. And this project was to look at, you know, what rights Indigenous people have, what are the gaps in all of the laws from copyright to heritage. And it also looked at putting recommendations forward, whether it be changes to existing laws, calls for new laws, and any sort of policy or non-legal measures that could better protect Indigenous arts, knowledge, culture. And so I got to work on that report, which was pretty incredible. Worked with an Indigenous reference group, which had prominent Indigenous people that had thought about this issue for many years. You know, Russ Taylor was like the contact point at the Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies. So it was just amazing. So I put out this report, you know, after it was about 2 years of doing this work, and there was a recommendation for new laws to give rights to Indigenous people for their knowledge, and nothing happened. There was a change in government. The commitment for this project had been with the previous government, so the new government wasn't really interested. And I remember feeling really deflated and then thinking, well, you know, the message is we should be asserting our rights. You know, the UN Declaration of Indigenous Peoples' Rights says we have these rights, let's go out there and do it. And I thought, well, I got to walk the talk and move out and do something. And I was really daunted by it. I really didn't know what was involved. But, you know, my husband and I spoke after that report was out. I was, you know, the new year. And I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to set up a law firm. And, yeah, that was the move, moving out and It was just me. It was the year 2000. And the law firm was officially set up on the 1st of April 2000, almost 26 years ago. And, you know, I look back on it now and I don't know what it was. You know, I'd had the, I sometimes say I just had those, had my second child and maybe I was going through postnatal high or whatever. What was really good was that Indigenous clients would start to come.
I just want to go back across a few things because you've covered a lot there. And I want to first of all acknowledge how critical our culture, our future was as a moment. And as you rightly say, it came out of that very active period. The Bringing Them Home report was commissioned at the same time and similarly met with a government with a very different agenda than the one who had commissioned it. But the report remained a real benchmark. Even today, it's seen as a very groundbreaking moment in our understanding around copyright law, intellectual property law, an agenda for law reform. So when you look back now at that report that's been so important in shaping the area, what are your reflections? Did you understand at the time that it would have such longevity and be so important?
I don't think I did. I probably put too much on the new law, you know, that there should be a law protecting traditional knowledge and cultural expression. But the report actually had other things like protocols, which was where I ended up taking this, which sort of put it back into the hands of First Nations people and being able to say, this is how we understand the right and this is how we want interactions with people coming to us to record our stories, to take our cultural knowledge of plants and what have you. It was the protocols that became the momentum. And, it was slow to start off with. But, you know, I remember straight after the Our Culture, Our Future report, which was, you know, AATSIS and ATSIC were starting to implement it. Very soon after we saw ATSIC's demise. But the AATSIS put together the guidelines for ethical research in Indigenous studies, which is now, you know, the precursor to the AATSIS Code of Ethics in research. And I thought that was a pinnacle moment because I could see people using parts of it to bring in these really big structural changes that the report illuminated. And, you know, it would move to the way libraries, archives and collections would deal with their interactions with Indigenous people, how they held, interpreted and understood its collections and, you know, like the woven baskets, the cultural artifacts. It was a shift in that way. And, you know, the arts practice was huge. Indigenous arts, the momentum there in the shifts with people using Our Culture, Our Future to advance Indigenous rights in the way they would negotiate a deal, the development of ICIP clauses within licensing agreements and contracts. For example, and then the pathways and protocols stuff within the film industry. There was a whole lot of work moving there with how filmmakers understood Indigenous cultural and intellectual property. So it was really taking off and there was a lot of resistance at start, I think, particularly I think scientific industries found it really difficult where they held this, I guess, conventional understanding that, you know, Indigenous knowledge was almost a resource or, you know, something to be extracted. And Indigenous people were always the informants. So this notion of collaborating or having Indigenous people as co-authors or co-inventors was very new and alien and in some ways very confronting. I remember some of the early conversations I had with people around that. But these days, you know, you see things like the State of the Environment report give real backing to the notion that traditional knowledge should be embedded in the way that we look after the environment, in the same way that Western science is used. It's, you know, it's Indigenous science. So there's been major shifts and, you know, our culture, our future is 27 years ago now, 28 years ago. And even though there's new law, there's no new laws, we're currently looking at a proposal to develop a new law, which, you know, I'm the chair of the expert working group on that ICIP legislation. So that's happening. But yes, there has been this real groundswell of work, and our culture, our future enable people to be able to take it up and develop things from it.
That's the first half of my conversation with lawyer and writer Dr. Terry Jenke. She's one of Australia's leading Indigenous lawyers and someone who has always put our people first.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. My guest this week is Dr. Terry Jenke. She's been a trailblazer in the legal sector, paving the way for new generations of Indigenous legal professionals. Most recently, she was involved in a formal review into racism here at the ABC. Coming up, you'll hear how the emergence of artificial intelligence, or AI, is causing us to reconsider how best to protect Indigenous cultural knowledge. That's King Stingray with their cover of the Coldplay classic Yellow, and it is one of my all-time favourites.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting.
The world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
Dr. Terry Jenke is regarded as an expert on Indigenous cultural and intellectual property, better known as ICIP. She's been at the forefront of efforts to further educate on the need to protect these rights for the advancement and protection of Indigenous people and communities.
I'm reflecting too, as you're speaking, that in obviously I have a big career in academia, and those AATSIS protocols have profoundly shaped the way research is done, as you say, and also with my work in film, the protocols have reshaped the way the industry engages as well. So I can actually, you know, reinforce this idea that without the legislation, the impact has been profound. Let's go back. I'm also noting that your law firm's birthday is the same day as mine, although I'm slightly older than your law firm. But so it must be a very auspicious date. You started just you and have grown it into one of the most successful law firms in the country. And I just wonder what your reflections are about what it took. And as you say, I often find that bravery is the most overrated virtue, because it usually means we've dived in without knowing what we're getting into. But I wonder what it's been like for you to build such a successful, highly recognised practice with a huge positive reputation, especially amongst the mob, and what it's been like to grow it. What have the challenges been over that time? And when you look back, how does it feel?
Well, it feels really rewarding, because I think back on all the people that we've worked with, all the clients, and, you know, we started off doing a lot of arts and cultural industry stuff, and we could move to help people who were setting up their own businesses, whether it be in consulting or textiles or graphic, and, you know, moved into the academic research sector, work with environment. We support Indigenous organisations from medical or, you know, health sector, community-controlled organisations, to the peak body, you know, the peak Indigenous groups. It's amazing. And we don't just do intellectual property. We can do things like helping them with governance or just their legal work. And I find it really incredible, actually, that the firm has gotten to be the size it has and to live, you know, coming on 26 years. And when I think back on it, you're right, I don't think I had any idea. It was a bit of a whim, bit of a, you know, let's have a go. I certainly felt it within the first 6 months of making that decision, because I can tell you now, I didn't make any money for a good 3 years. I wasn't good at business. I had great ideas. I did a lot of work for free, ran the office out of the back of an architect's firm in Redfern for the first year, then, you know, moved sort of always at the periphery of the city. And, you know, running a business is hard. And what I could know about the law, which was hard enough because, you know, I didn't have a firm that had the backing of a big precedent database or stuff like that. Everything I did, it was, you know, inventing for the first time. And, after the first year, things are really tough. And some of my first employees, like, you know, the wonderful Robin Quiggin, who's a Wiradjuri lawyer, was one of my first lawyers. Angelina Hurley, she's another First Nations woman, was in the office. And I had this vision to, you know, run the office, you know, even with the three of us. And it became really apparent that I couldn't get the client base. We just didn't have the reputation. I didn't know how to seal the deal. I didn't know how to quote properly. I was shame job about talking about money. And it just wasn't good. So after the second year, I had to scale back down, and Robin and Angelina left me, and I was back alone. And that was really hard. I think that, you know, your pride gets in the way. You think like, that's, you know, should I just give it up? Because you also see your friends excelling. You watch your Larissa Behrens doing amazing things in the world and, you know. And
well, we grabbed Robin Quiggin when you let her go too.
Yes, so. Absolutely. And all the time I'm struggling to, you know, really make a living. And I was lucky to, I had a husband that was able to support me. You know, we had a young family, but I just knew that I wasn't going to give up and would call my mom and she would say, you know, don't give up, keep going. And yeah, there were clients that would come, and I'm still inspired by, you know, one of my first clients was Lorraine Peters, who runs the Marimali program, a healing program for the Stolen Gens. She's a survivor of Cootamundra Girls Home. Remember, she sought me out, knocked on my door in the Redfern office and said, you know, I heard there was an Indigenous lawyer doing law and, you know, I need you to help me protect my IP in this training program that I have. And, you know, she's still a client of mine. And, you know, things like that just really buoyed me along, that I had these people that would, you know, back me, pay for my services and stay with me. And I guess it grew from word of mouth. I just had to do crash courses on everything business. I did a lot of reading courses. Indigenous Business Australia helped me with a business plan. The New South Wales business development people supported me with developing my website, doing courses. And I just had to learn how to work on the business, not just be a lawyer. And, you know, I'm still learning, you know, every day in this, because it's a matter of also doing the law. And, you know, we were doing cutting edge law. We were pioneering things that, you know, there were no templates, no, you had to convince the other side to take up these issues in contracts and, you know, speak for clients who were trying to speak about, you know, let's protect cultural integrity and, you know, let's not give away all our copyright and have a negotiated way, when the whole of the industry before had had that approach of taking all rights in perpetuity in all media, now known and yet to be devised, was a sort of language in the contracts. So we were pushing up against that and it was hard. And, you know, it really took me a good 10 years to get the flow of things. And then we started to grow. We started to see people wanting to work in this area, both Indigenous and also non-Indigenous.
That is such an inspiring story, and thank you so much for sharing that. We often look at somebody like you and their success and we don't appreciate the hard work and that's really gone in behind that, the hard yards, the long hours, the ups and downs. I want to take you now to some of the substantive work that you're looking at shaping today, and perhaps for our listeners who aren't familiar with the concept of ICIP or Indigenous Cultural Intellectual Property, could you give a bit of an overview about now what we should understand that phrase to mean?
Yeah, sure. Indigenous cultural and intellectual property is Indigenous people's rights to their traditional knowledge and their traditional cultural expression. So it's basically their heritage. So it's things like the stories of country, song lines, knowledge of plants and animals, it's language, it's also the intellectual property of objects like the woven baskets, boomerangs, spears. It's also knowledge of sites and places, including sites of significance. But, you know, it's all places have stories connected to it. And it also includes things like where our knowledge has been recorded in sound recordings and films, in ethnographic reports, There's a lot been written about Indigenous people over the years. So it's basically things that Indigenous people have to express their culture. And the rights are the rights to maintain, control and protect all of that, because over history, that right has not been ours. It's been other people who have written stories and, you know, been the ones that have captured the stories and said where it can go and how it's controlled. So Indigenous people want to be the authors and the creators, or, you know, the decision makers around that. And another right is to protect the integrity of it, because there's been a lot of false and misleading representations, things used out of context, also sacred knowledge that should not be published, men's business, women's business. Those are the sort of things Indigenous people are talking about. And also the lack of attribution, that people think that they can just take knowledge, and in the past people did, but there was no connection kept back to where it came from. So the sort of author unknown labels that were on works in galleries many years ago, that connection was lost. And also the right to benefit share. So these are things that are what Indigenous people see as fundamental ICIP rights.
And we've spoken about the role you've had in terms of introducing protocols around research, around science, around the arts. But given that we're going into a new technological era, and particularly with AI, what do you see as some of the challenges for ICIP in the space of these new technologies where everything is so extractive?
Yeah, it's just going to amplify it in a way that is just mega fast. So we're just catching up with things, with protocols, and also just the first steps towards an ICIP law, and then we're hit with AI being able to train these very constantly developing systems on Indigenous knowledge using content that is out there, which can basically then interpret and use Indigenous knowledge without any reference to cultural knowledge, without any consideration of those practices and recognition of ICIP rights. So AI has no dreaming. It is no understanding of those nuances, and it causes unique risks and harm for Indigenous people. I mean, there's risks to all people and AI and copyright and people talking about that. But we have specific cultural harms that are amplified through AI.
What are some of the things that you think need to happen? I know you've mentioned you're working on quite important legislation, but how do we protect these cultural rights going forward?
Well, I always advocate for the protocols, the True Tracks protocols, the 10 principles that we developed to basically guide people through what can be good recognition of ICIP rights. And I won't take you through all 10, but it's really just about thinking about Indigenous people, going back to how they can maintain, control and protect and develop their cultural heritage and intellectual property. So in what ways can you respect Indigenous people's right to speak to their culture? How can they participate in decision making? So people can think about this at the start of any project that seeks to use knowledge, rather than think of it as an afterthought, which has always been the case. I think authenticity or truth-telling is another thing. When we are in the face of AI-generated outputs, you know, that can imitate and appropriate and misrepresent Indigenous knowledge or Indigenous culture, it's often done with someone else's interpretation. So this aspect of truth-telling or authenticity is going to look at the source, the interpretation, the context, the significance, and look to, you know, things like, am I cultural stereotyping, tokenism? You want to avoid that. So it is being cognizant of the way that you use knowledge is not misinterpreting it and misappropriating it in a way that demeans culture. And I think cultural harm, people don't understand, you know, this right to cultural knowledge is something Indigenous people see at the heart of their cultural practice and really, really important in colonised societies where land and water rights have been taken away from people and knowledge becomes such a cultural inheritance that they guard and want to speak for and protect. So these rights are about keeping it strong within cultural groups, being able to speak for it and being able to nurture it. So those opportunities must spring forth, and it's to take part in it with economic opportunities too. So using art, styles, language, storytelling without attribution or authorization and connection to Indigenous communities seems like it is devaluing that exchange. And, you know, not that you need to pay for everything, but there are benefits in mutual benefits and going back to Indigenous people for that use. And then enabling them to be the ones to maintain and protect culture so they can have living cultural practices that come out of these projects, and that intergenerational transmission of cultural knowledge can continue.
And when you look back at where things were when you started out, when you came back to your law studies because you'd found the area that you were really passionate about, and you look back now and see how the landscape's changed, how would you describe where we are now compared to where we were then?
There's a lot that's changed. I mean, some are still the same, but I see there's a lot of artists, Aboriginal artists, that are now more able to advocate for licensing rather than assignment of copyright. There's a lot of good collaborations occurring. I mean, there's still appropriation, what have you, but we're seeing opportunities in a scale that was not about in you know, 25 years ago. You see things like collaborations with artists with fashion houses like Country Road, or artwork being you know, put on the Opera House, and people understand that more as a, you know, you got to use Indigenous artists and compensate them and think about cultural integrity aspects. I think there's a lot of more understanding in industry. Business is yet to grow in that. What I also see is growth in people, opportunity for Indigenous people to work in other sectors. I mean, it's still yet to be realised, but I think of Bush Foods, there's an opportunity there for Indigenous people to develop new food products. It's a market that we're so underrepresented in, not enough resources put into that to enable Indigenous people to participate. But we are seeing some developments of groups developing products more than we did back then. It was always seen as, you know, a bigger company taking that opportunity. And we're seeing Indigenous companies looking to think of ways that they might be involved in medicines as well, or new innovations, Indigenous groups working with universities to patent things like, you know, sort of nanofibers that come from Spinifex on country is happening up in Queensland. They're pretty innovative. And we're seeing companies, Indigenous companies, doing digital things as well. And that's really important. And we're still yet to break the back on, you know, being able to have it totally recognised. But we have those inroads now. And I think ICIP has become much more well known.
I have to say, Terry, it was a long time getting you on the show, but it's been such a privilege to sit here and reflect on your extraordinary career, your extraordinary contribution, and the extraordinary person that you are. For me, you embody the concept of Black excellence, and I'm just so proud that I saw you at the beginning of the journey and I've been able to cheer from the sidelines as you've reached your potential.
I appreciate that. That's so lovely. And it's a pleasure being on Speaking Out. And thank you for all your support over the years, Larissa.
That's my conversation with Indigenous lawyer Dr. Terry Janke. I really enjoyed our time together. Terry is someone who I've always had a strong connection with, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaya Gibbs-Muir. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our Titter Show Away, hosted by the fabulous Rudy Bremer. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.